Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Stephanie Sanders talks with Steve Berg about a new report that came out last week regarding the state's homeless population. First, legislative hearings on Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear's budget balancing plan continue in Frankfort. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh zeroes in on how budget cuts are affecting one particular agency, Kentucky State Police.
Kentucky State Police has an authorized force strength of 1,070, but that goal has never been achieved. Right now, there are 906 state troopers, but only 879 are available for duty due to National Guard deployments and injuries. On January 4th, a new cadet class began at Kentucky State Police Academy in Frankfort. 65 recruits signed up, but by the first day of class, the number was down to 56. A week later, only 41 cadets remain, and KSP Commissioner Rodney Brewer says it remains to be seen how many of them will survive the grueling 23-week course.
The training is very, very rigorous from a physical standpoint and also from a mental standpoint, and there's a lot of reasons for that that we don't make any apologies for. My goal and the goal of the Kentucky State Police Academy is to turn out the very best product for the Commonwealth that we can.
Justice Secretary Michael Brown wants that too. He knows even if 40 cadets graduate, it won't make much of a dent in KSP's personnel needs.
That is, in and of itself, probably not going to close the gap for those who are likely to retire next summer. So even with this particular cadet class, we are going to be at a level of strength that is going to be probably at a generational low.
In fact, the number of state troopers is at a 30-year low. And Secretary Brown says it's getting harder and harder to attract qualified new recruits.
We're going to, at some point, have to address our training facilities in an academy, because it's difficult to attract the best and the brightest for what is going to be a very difficult job. Our troopers, unlike urban police forces, they have to be well prepared to handle a lot of situations by themselves.
And they need good cars. Brown says KSP's current fleet of cruisers is rapidly aging.
This past summer was an economic disaster when gas topped out at $4 a gallon and you're driving 2 million miles a year. Those numbers become staggering. The cars have a shelf life. A good piece of our fleet has more than 100,000 miles on it.
KSP's rebuilding effort comes at a bad time. The state already faces a $456 million budget shortfall, and most economic experts warn next year could be even worse. Governor Beshear is ordering most state agencies to cut spending by 4%. He's giving KSP a break and ordering it to make 2% cuts, but that's still $1.3 million. During hearings on the governor's budget balancing plan, Senate Budget Chairman Charlie Borders told Secretary Brown he wishes the state could do more for KSP.
We made great strides a few years back, and we gave a nice increase. We can never pay them what we'd like to, but to our troopers, I think we increased their salary like something like $6,000.
The budget crunch has some lawmakers suggesting now would be a good time to elevate vehicle enforcement officers to state trooper status, something KSP has resisted for years. But as Secretary Brown and Commissioner Brewer point out, even that action would require more money for training, salary equity, and the restriping of police cruisers. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
A new report out last week from the National Alliance to End Homelessness says Kentucky's homeless rate grew more sharply than any other states between 2005 and 2007. Stephanie Sanders spoke with the vice president of the organization, Steve Berg, about the study and what it means for Kentucky and Louisville.
First, tell me a little bit about how you guys compile the numbers for this study.
Okay, well, for the past several years, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has been asking communities to do their own local surveys and censuses of people who are homeless. For many years, the federal government has been giving communities money to help deal with homelessness, but it was only in the last few years they really started focusing on more on sort of how are we doing? Is this problem getting worse? Is it getting better? And the way they've really gotten to that is by asking communities to do these counts every 2 years.
So you get the number from local communities doing homeless census counts?
Yes. The local community does a count. They send the information to the federal government, and then we get it from them.
And then what sorts of trends are you guys observing in those numbers?
Well, I think it's interesting because things are changing over time. This report covers the period from January 2005 to January 2007, which is almost 2 years ago now. And during that period, we found that homelessness was actually going down around the country, certainly not in every community, but in the country as a whole, and particularly among people who were sort of the hardest cases, people who've been on the street for a long time with severe mental illnesses. Homelessness is going down there quite a bit, largely because we believe the federal government has for a number of years invested money in housing for that group, and I think we were seeing the results of that. Now, since then, of course, you know, January of 2007 was sort of the low point for the unemployment rate. Unemployment started going up in March of 2007. In December 2007, we now know the recession officially began, and we're now hearing from all over the country that homelessness is going up again as a result of people not being able to get jobs and the state and local governments not having money for programs. So the situation was getting better for a while, but now it every indication that it appears to be getting worse.
Sure. And I guess the thing, in looking at the report, the thing that caught my attention as a broadcaster in Louisville is that Kentucky had the highest rate of increase in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys look in at all as to why that is?
Well, we haven't yet. I mean, we get the national data. We take the numbers that the local communities give to HUD. Now, what we always do sort of as a follow-up to this, what we'll be doing next is looking at some of the places, one that got the sort of best results and also places that got the worst results, really trying to look at those communities and see what we can learn from there. Sometimes it's just a matter of people do a better job of counting, so the number's higher. But other times there are changes in the community that really have made the problem worse. So we're going to be looking into that as best we can.
That is also the case with, because while I'm seeing a 60%+ increase in the homelessness rate here, I'm also seeing in some places a 60%+ decrease. So you guys are going to be looking at both the places on both the high and the low end.
Right.
To see what caused those changes.
Right, because we want to be able to help communities learn from each other. You know, the places that are doing the best job and getting the best results, we want to see what exactly they're doing and help other communities learn from that. Then in other places, if we're seeing places where the numbers have really gone up, then we want to help figure out what's causing that.
How long have you guys been doing these studies?
Well, this will be only the second year that we've done this. So, like I said, HUD started doing these counts in January 2005. It took them a long time to get the results out from the first round. So just about a year ago, we put out the first homelessness counts report based on that initial information. And then this is the second one, but it's the first time where we've had sort of two different data points to compare.
Sure, and I imagine, I mean, as it goes on, you'll be able to see pattern. I mean, because as you said earlier, you know, in some cases when you see dramatic changes, it might just be because they're doing a better job of counting.
That's absolutely right.
So the longer it goes, the more reliable data you'll have. Are you looking into ways at all that you can, I guess, standardize the way the censuses are being taken?
We're trying to help HUD with that. Of course, we're not in charge of the census. HUD's in charge of the census, so we can't, you know, we're not in a position where we can give anybody orders about this is how you should do it. But we are trying to, like I said, we're trying to help communities learn from each other. And one of the things we're trying to help communities learn is how to do the count in the most effective and the most accurate and reliable way.
So what should people take away from learning or seeing these new numbers?
Well, I think on the national level, I think one thing we learned from this is that when the economy is good and when the federal government is investing serious resources in this problem, the problem definitely gets better. And this, I mean, it sounds sort of obvious, but I think for the longest time, people just thought, well, there's nothing you can do about homelessness. And I think this shows that, in fact, there is. And that, in fact, the kinds of investments that we saw over the last several years from the feds, the kinds of changes that communities have made in the way they deal with the problem are having an impact. They're having, in most places, a positive impact. But I think the other side of it is that we're also going to see that the problem is not yet solved. When the economy gets worse, homelessness goes up, and that we need, right now, we need some sort of crisis-level intervention to deal with the fact that the recession is causing homelessness to skyrocket in a lot of places.
Learn more about the National Alliance to End Homelessness study at our website, WFPL.org. The burst of the nation's housing bubble last year has apparently done little to disturb a trend that began developing before the mortgage crisis. Industry analysts say in some cities, many home buyers are abandoning suburban living for lofts and condos in downtown areas. Gabe Bullard has a look at what's happening here in Louisville.
Usually if I'm showing folks around, I start over here.
Melody Jones can see Iroquois Park from her living room, even though she lives more than 6 miles away, on the 8th floor of the Henry Clay Building downtown. She moved here from the suburbs.
We had the typical 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath, garage, 2-car garage house there.
This is a very small family room. We spend a lot of time in front of this fireplace, and in the evening times we watch TV in here.
Sam Rector also moved downtown from the suburbs. He lives in the Waterfront Park Place building.
Right now we live on one floor, a single floor plan, which I like. I don't miss the steps at all. We used to have a 3-story house and we had a lot of steps.
Rector and Jones are what developers call urban pioneers. They moved downtown despite the absence of malls, grocery stores, and other retail in their new neighborhoods. They say in addition to the view and cozier rooms, they're excited about the downtown development that will be spurred by construction of Louisville's new arena.
I think the day of the McMansion, 5,000 square foot with the 3 bathrooms on the second floor and 5 bedrooms on the second floor, the living room, kitchen, dining room on the first floor, and the washer and dryer in the basement may be over.
Ron Crouch is director of the Kentucky State Data Center. He predicts the shift to smaller dwellings, including those in downtown areas, will continue.
I'm afraid in many of our large subdivisions with huge homes, I don't see the market down the road. I think you're going to have a market for ranch-style homes, one-floor homes with a full bedroom on the first floor, and smaller homes.
Downtown developers say their units are filling up. And Indiana University Southeast Finance Professor Eric Dufresne says the evidence is clear where many of the urban pioneers are coming from.
I think you could surmise that it's coming probably from the suburbs because we're not seeing a significant increase in population of Jefferson County.
Developers are counting on others to follow the pioneers downtown. They say empty nesters and young people are drawn to urban cores the way baby boomers were first drawn to suburbs. But for areas to thrive, they need people and retail. Right now, Dufresne says there's not enough of both to support downtown and the suburbs.
Unless you have an increase in population or an increase in income, you only have so many retail dollars to go around. And so any new retail establishment downtown simply removes or transfers dollars from the suburbs to downtown. And we've seen that in Louisville.
The downtown trend is a reversal of the urban flight of the latter 20th century. After World War II, highways, a baby boom, and economic growth helped push populations to the suburbs. Now, high gas prices, smaller families, and other factors are pulling them back. Eric Dufresne says that could mean a glut of suburban housing.
As downtown regions continue to develop, and as people move downtown, someone will have to buy that housing stock in the suburbs. And unless the area sees an increase in population, you could have some difficulties down the road. I'm talking long term here.
Downtown resident Melody Jones and her husband say they know about the difficulties of selling suburban homes.
We have one for sale in Shelbyville that we can't get rid of. We can't give it away for the price that was paid 5 years ago.
The Joneses also own an extra condo downtown, which they expect to sell before closing on the Shelbyville property. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer looks at infrastructure in the arts community. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Still ahead, we'll learn more about a cancer awareness event coming up in Louisville. First, President-elect Barack Obama's plan to aid the national economy includes $350 billion in spending on infrastructure, from water systems to broadband networks. Cultural institutions aren't part of the package, but arts leaders in Kentucky and beyond are thinking more seriously about their infrastructure needs and their role in the economy. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
1 minute, please. The Kentucky Center is packed with patrons for a long-awaited event, the Louisville premiere of the Broadway hit Wicked. But behind the scenes is another highly anticipated event, a major upgrade of this 25-year-old state-owned facility. Last year, the state approved a series of bond issues of $9 million to bring it up to date. Center President Stephen Klein says he hopes some of the funding comes through soon.
If, in fact, we get something this February, we will be able this summer to do our lighting dimming systems, elevators, restrooms, and a new stage floor for the Whitney.
The rest of the long overdue work will take place through the summer of 2011, including replacing massive backstage equipment that has been unusable for years. It's a familiar scenario to the Nonprofit Finance Fund, which sees nonprofits put off much-needed infrastructure overhauls. The fund advises nonprofits and has lent more than $200 million to small and mid-sized organizations. Its president, Clara Miller, says covering capital expenses is crucial to efficiently managing an arts organization.
It takes, in the case of arts organizations, almost $4 of investment in bricks and mortar to earn a dollar of revenue. And that depreciates every year, and so that adds to the cost of doing business. It's invisible to the public, and it's invisible to most of us in our own houses until, you know, the roof starts leaking.
In the case of Bowling Green's Capital Arts Center, it was the ceiling. In 2003, the center closed the building for months to repair the crumbling ceiling and more. Costs ran nearly $500,000 and depleted its endowment. Today, the center is up and running, but still has problems. Last year, it asked the state for $1.5 million, but got nothing due to the tight state budget. The center's manager, Karen Hume, says she struggles to raise funds for capital projects.
We try to do what fundraising we can. We go to our county and our city and beg for extra money and basically get down on our knees and pray that it's out there.
Call it begging or call it lobbying. That's what the Kentucky Center did to get its money. Art centers commonly work with lawmakers to find funds for capital projects. Often it comes tucked in earmarks or through urban renewal or even transportation programs at the state and federal levels. But two states have created specific funding sources for cultural facilities that also require a percentage of private funding. In 2006, an economic stimulus package in Massachusetts created the Cultural Facilities Fund. It's awarded nearly $24 million to more than 100 institutions from the state's general fund. And Mississippi has distributed nearly $18 million since 2001 for renovation or construction of 90 facilities through its Building Fund for the Arts. Like the Kentucky Center upgrade, that program is funded through bonds. Mississippi State Senator John Horn says the program has bipartisan support for several reasons.
We here in Mississippi are finally understanding and making the connection between our arts and culture as an important ingredient in who we are and what it means to us in terms of tourism development, quality of life, and things like that.
Some economists see value in these programs even during this economy. One is Ann Markison with the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs.
Those are very, very good ideas, and especially the extent to which they're protected. So, of course, if it's out of your general fund, that makes it vulnerable. I think Mississippi, it's more immune to these kinds of downturns.
Other economists and arts administrators say investments in cultural facilities come back to communities when the events they host attract customers and tourists, even to nearby businesses. For now, that case isn't one a financially strapped Kentucky legislature is considering. but many arts administrators say lawmakers should and have a plan ready for arts institutions statewide when the economy improves. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Louisville's Norton Cancer Institute has announced a new campaign to raise money for cancer research, education, and other programs. The Ride to Conquer Cancer is a bicycle trip later this year from Louisville to Lexington and back. I spoke with Norton Healthcare Chief Development Officer Lenny Meyer about the event.
This began with an event this past week in Louisville, correct?
That's right. We announced the inaugural ride of the Ride to Conquer Cancer, which will benefit the Norton Cancer Institute. And we're going to take folks from Louisville to Lexington on bicycles in September. We're going to drive on a two-day journey through beautiful bluegrass country and at the same time raise awareness and raise dollars to support the Norton Cancer Institute.
Now, this is not any one particular type of cancer. This is to battle all types?
That's right. We're focusing on really outreach, prevention, and education. As a state, we have such a high incidence of cancers, and we've really mobilized resources around prevention and screening. So a significant amount of the funding will support that, and also clinical research throughout Norton Healthcare. We are seeing more patients with cancer than any other provider in our region, and a lot of the research dollars in our community have gone to pure lab or bench-level research. And so looking as an organization at how we translate that into clinical care and actually improve outcomes for patients while they're going through their cancer treatment.
How does this work? How does it generate money?
Well, there's a registration fee. We are recruiting all types of riders, not just athletes, but all levels of folks we're inviting to ride. We think we'll have about 30% of the folks come out that are actually cancer survivors. You log on to ridetovictory.org, register to ride, pay a registration fee. It covers all of your food along the way, your lodging in Lexington, and then we're asking our riders to help us by securing pledges.
Now, is this the first year for the event?
It is. It's the first year, but it's unlike any other ride that's ever happened in our region. I think it's going to be a really high-energy event, and it'll be a ton of fun with about 1,200 riders.
Do you know at this point how many people might be taking part?
We've got about 150 people registered already, which we think is great in January, and we've got a lot of good early momentum. But we're shooting for 1,000 people to be out there on bikes.
This doesn't necessarily have to be people on bikes. You can use other modes of transport if you like.
Most of the folks are going to be on bicycles, but we're also recruiting volunteers and crew members to help along the way. So there's lots of ways to get involved, and we're looking really just to raise awareness and raise dollars to support the Cancer Institute, and we need people to come out and help with crew, people to volunteer, and people to ride. Folks can call 877-688-BIKE, or they can log on to www.ridetovictory.org.
Let's talk a little bit about cancer in Kentucky and in this area. What is the most common form of cancer that you're treating now?
We see a high incidence of breast cancers, a lot of lung cancer, prostate cancer. It's really across the board, skin cancers. And we have found that early detection and prevention is the greatest way as a state for us to get in front of that. You know, we have a high incidence of obesity. We have a high incidence of smoking. And last year we screened over 2,000 people through our mobile prevention vehicle, and about 15% of them came back with abnormal screenings, and we were able to intervene more quickly. So, a lot of these cancers are preventable. Certainly they're treatable, and if we can screen them early and get people connected to care, we can really improve outcomes for the state.
And again, the details, that's coming up in September, correct?
That's right. September 25th, 6th, and 7th. The ride is actually on the 26th and 27th. There's orientation and safety training on the 25th. But 3 days that we're dedicating to the Ride to Conquer Cancer, and we're going to be going from Louisville to Lexington and back through Kentucky's beautiful bluegrass region.
Should be a great time of year to do that.
Gorgeous. September's a great month to see Kentucky, and we feel very good about the event and just want folks to come out and register and be part of it.
Well, you had some hardy souls this past week that for the groundbreaking event
that actually did that. We had a lot of people who braved the cold temperatures this week and got out on spinning bikes, and we've got a lot of people excited who are already training and getting ready for the ride.
Okay, Lenny Meyer with Norton Healthcare. Thanks so much and good luck with the event.
Thank you. Take care.
There's nothing unusual about seeing a man walking along a Kentucky road with his dogs. But Luke Robinson and his two Great Pyrenees aren't typical. Robinson and his four-legged companions are walking across the country from Austin, Texas to Boston, Massachusetts, a feat undertaken by Robinson to help raise awareness about and money for research on canine cancer. His mission was sparked by the loss of another Pyrenees to bone cancer in 2006. The cross-country trek brought Robinson through Louisville, where he's spending a few days this week for a couple of events. Susan Sweeney Crum caught up with him to find out more about his foundation, his two dogs, 2,000 miles, and the trip.
Luke Robinson, you are walking across the country with two faithful companions, two Great Pyrenees dogs. Can you tell us why you're doing this?
Sure, Susan. In 2004, I lost my dog, Malcolm, to osteosarcoma. It's a particularly aggressive type of bone cancer, and it ultimately spread to his lungs. And he wasn't my blood, but he was my boy. And my experience with cancer and his subsequent loss when the cancer spread to his lungs, it deeply and profoundly affected me, impacted me, and it made me realize that there's a big need in canine cancer. And so my two dogs and I put my stuff in storage, sold my truck, and we got on the road.
Why a walk? What made you decide to walk across the country?
Well, I think because the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome is letting people know that dogs get cancer and they get the same types of cancer that people get. So since awareness really is the crux or the most important thing that we're hoping to accomplish, I knew we'd have to do something substantial.
How do you do this in terms of going from one? You've said it's coming up on a year now. You've actually been walking. Do you just keep going from one place to the next on your way to Boston? And where do you stay? And how logistically does this work?
Well, that's a great question. It's actually I think the better question is where do we not sleep? We sleep on the road. We pitch a tent on church property sometimes. Folks will allow us to stay at their house upon occasion. We like to have like what we call a host family or a foster family in each in the bigger cities that help with transportation and logistics. But basically, you know, I put my stuff into storage, got on the road, and we've been walking and traveling ever since. And I'm sure, as you can imagine, we only can carry about 4, maybe max 5 days worth of supplies at a time. So we have a team of volunteers that help out sending us supplies and food and gear and equipment along the way. So we have a team of volunteers that make sure that we have everything we need on the road.
That sounds like then quite a sacrifice. I mean, this is obviously must mean a lot to you to make that kind of sacrifice, that you don't really have a place you're living. You don't have a nice comfy bed to sleep in every night. It's that important to you.
It is. I mean, it is. It's quite an adjustment. You know, there are days when we wake up and we start walking, well, I have no idea where we're going to be sleeping that night. You know, even the days off are a little bit taxing. So it's quite an adjustment, especially when you look at my background, which I have a BBA in finance and accounting, and I had a business consulting practice. So it's definitely a little bit of a different type of lifestyle, but it does mean a lot to me, Susan. Malcolm was my boy, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done with canine cancer, and I've devoted the rest of my life to this. This is a lifelong mission for me. So it's hard, it's tough on the road sometimes. You know, it's a bit dangerous too. It can be a bit dangerous, but I have two wonderful traveling companions, Hudson and Murphy, and we truly have become a pack in the truest sense. And where I go, they go. Where they go, I go. And so, if I didn't have them, and I wasn't doing this for something I truly believed in, I couldn't do something like this.
Why do you think? I mean, I know there's specialties for every kind of dog thing out there, it seems like, anymore. I know when I had my dog at the vet, someone was coming in to have cataracts removed. So I know the doctors exist, and they must know there's cancer out there. Do you think do people in general just not know? Because it seems like the vets know all about it. An owner who has a dog with cancer knows about it. But Is there not much research going on or not?
Well, when you compare it to the amount of research that's done on human diseases and human conditions, it's, you know, we're not even really a rounding error. So there's not a lot. I mean, yes, there's some wonderful studies being done, but the typical clinical trial of clinical trial for cancer drugs, you know, may involve anywhere just up to a couple of dozen of dogs. So they're comparatively small to human studies. So that is one of the problems. And you're right. I mean, because of my own personal intimate experience with canine cancer, I didn't imagine that I would meet so many people on the road that had no idea that dogs get cancer. And the ones that do, they think that dog cancer is different from human cancer. And when in fact what science has taught us, Susan, is that the dog is a wonderful model for understanding cancers in humans, in a whole area called comparative oncology.
Now, on Wednesday, you are going to be in an event, and it's a free event, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
So this is for people who just want to find out. I mean, you're going to share your story. There's also going to be some veterinary specialists. They can find out a little bit more about what is available and what's going on and what you're trying to accomplish as well. Tell us a little bit about what's going to go on Wednesday.
You're going to say the truth. I don't have a really good idea. It's really the way this works is my people tell me where to go and what to do, and I go and I do. So I know that I'm going to be doing a PowerPoint presentation and showing a slideshow of you know, some of the pictures and photos from our experiences and some of the cool people we met and some of the wonderful, beautiful cancer dogs that have come into our lives along the road. And so we'll be doing that.
You can find out more about Robinson's mission or meet him and his dogs Wednesday evening between 7 and 9 in the Brown and Williamson room at Papa John's Cardinal Stadium. More information is at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer interviews a new curator at the Speed Museum. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher interviews a Bullitt County teacher about her first novel. First, last week, Suzanne Weaver began her work as the new curator of contemporary art at the Speed Art Museum after working as an associate curator at the Dallas Museum of Art since 1995. Weaver took some time to speak with Elizabeth Kramer about her achievements in Texas and her ideas for showcasing contemporary art at the Speed.
How do you see your job as the Speed Museum's new curator of contemporary art?
I see my job as bringing people together at the museum and in the community to advance the museum in a higher level in the national arena as well as international, to become more well-known. And one way to do it is with contemporary art.
And what kind of contemporary art are you thinking about or have you worked with in the past?
My focus has been mostly emerging art, and I've done a lot with media-based work, multidisciplinary work, video, film, and installation, as well as the traditional painting and sculpture.
And how do you plan to showcase contemporary art at the museum?
I want to find innovative ways to showcase contemporary art with other parts of the collection throughout the museum. Don't do it in expected ways in one gallery per se. Also, we have a number of sophisticated collectors in Louisville, and we have some great works in the collection to combine the two from the community as well as from the museum and do shows that focus on collecting and our resources that are here on hand.
And what did you learn when you were at the Dallas Museum of Art that you think really prepares you for this job.
We had some incredible, which I see here too, innovative and entrepreneurial patrons and supporters. And what we learned at the museum was bringing the patrons together, the colleagues together, the director, and to develop plans for acquisitions and exhibitions and fundraising.
What were some of the projects and exhibitions that you headed up there?
Well, I did over 21 Concentrations, which is our project-based series of international artists. And in that, I really raised the level of ambition. And we did several projects from Phil Collins' The World Won't Listen, which was a karaoke version to The Smiths, to one of the artists in Dallas, Paul Slocum, who does computer hacking and music composition. And for our 100th anniversary, I organized an exhibition called Come Forward, Emerging Art in Texas. And it was all artists just beginning their career. And I went, did 75 studio visits all through Texas. I also worked with local artists and emerging artists in Texas as well as nationally and internationally.
And how did that resonate with the community?
I found ways to plan programming, from docent training to gallery talks to come up with ideas of innovative ways to program around an exhibition. I also organized film festivals, music festivals, and so forth with emerging art. And I think the museum has a responsibility to the local art scene because it's a great relationship where we can help the community and enrich the community.
If you could give me a specific example of an achievement that you're most proud of from your experience in Dallas.
We ended up having Bill Viola's The Crossing, which is his masterpiece. Phil Collins' The World Won't Listen, a three-part video installation that he worked on for 4 years where he traveled to Bogota and to Istanbul and to Indonesia to do this karaoke version to The Smiths' album, The World Won't Listen. Other things that I'm very proud of is getting more people excited about contemporary art and building up more collectors and a bigger collecting base and getting people more active in the museum.
And have you had a chance to look at the collection at the Speed yet?
I have had just a run through, and there's some really good things. The museum has a good history, it's got a great staff, and it has great potential. I think Louisville is also one of the coolest cities in the country right now, and it has a great combination of history, but it also has a real openness and an entrepreneurial spirit. The other thing that I love about Louisville is it's got one of the great indie music scenes. And finding ways that the museum can bring in people like Steve Wilson and Gil Holland and Al Shantz, all these people that are doing really interesting things. It's a time to really think how to share resources and talent and works of art.
You talked about potential for the Speed in contemporary art. Where do you think those are?
I don't have this kind of ego. It's got to be this one thing. I think creativity is a communal thing. And I think you gain so much ideas from other people. The Speed itself and Charles Venable and the curators and the whole staff, they're ready to do things they haven't done before in contemporary art, do installations, bring media really in a big way. And with Idea Fest here, there's a real opportunity to do things that are like multidisciplinary. And the way the economy is now, all museums are going through with their endowments going down. I think it's a real exciting time and a challenging time where museums need to rethink how they've been doing things for so long, how they've been doing exhibitions, to be more creative and innovative in looking at their collection and using that, realizing what a great source it is.
Well, you talked about how you connected with the community outside the walls of the museum mm-hmm. in Dallas. What are some of the ways that you did that you think could be applicable here?
I would bring people in the community to talk about what programming would be, whether it's a panel, whether it's a gallery talks. I had the different universities' art departments do things with them, even to the arts magnet. So sometimes I'd have the artists that come and do installations, teach and do critiques in the universities. And we gave awards to artists. And a lot of those artists later on found their ways either teaching, sketching in the gallery, or doing talks, or actually organizing exhibitions and so forth.
What's going to be on your plate in the coming months?
We have that wonderful Vogel gift.
Can you talk about that a little bit, uh-huh. the Vogel gift?
Well, the Vogels are collectors. He was a postman and she was a librarian, and they started collecting art in the 60s. and they focused on conceptual and minimalism. And they lived in this small rent control apartment in New York and just filled it with art. They used the salary for him as a postman just to buy art. And they bought it when people weren't even buying those things. And so they have this enormous, wonderful collection of Richard Tuttle's and Barry's and Christo and so forth. And they gave a number of works to the National Gallery in Washington. And the Speed was recognized as one of the museums to receive 50 works from their collection. So that opens in March, and it's an opportunity to show works from the Speed that also complement that work. And then also I'm going to reinstall the contemporary galleries and try to bring works that haven't been shown. And then after that is this enormous, rich, great collection of photography that Henry Heiser has given to the museum or is in collecting. It tells the whole story of photography. And then after that, I'm working on, which was so interesting, because when I walked through the storage of the Speed and I saw these Tony Craigs and Richard Long and some other British artists, I went to Al Shands, an amazing collector and thoughtful, intelligent man. And he has all this wonderful British sculpture. So I want to do a British sculpture show, or British art, really, because we have these drawings at the museum by Howard Hodgkins. So I think this is a real time to focus on what we have here in the museum and the community to get people to celebrate and to recognize it. I think it's a great time.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Remember high school, hanging out with your best friend, breaking up, and then getting back together with your boyfriend or girlfriend, the homework and the parties, and yes, the stress of being a teenager. So what about kids today? Local author Bethany Griffin thinks some things have changed and some things remain the same. Robin Fisher talked with Griffin about her teen novel, Handcuffs.
Well, the book is set in high school, or with high schoolers, I should say, and really, sex is sort of the main theme going on. There are a lot of different things going on with the book, but sex is sort of the one that jumps out at you. Do you think that high school students today are having as much sex as is portrayed in the book? And one thing that struck me about it is it's very game-like.
To answer the game-like thing, you do hear rumors about, and I haven't heard those at my high school, but I think some of those may be urban legends about situations with, you know, bracelets and things that people wear to indicate things about sexuality. That's not something that I know a lot about. In the book, the main character's older sister is sexually active. She's married at this time, but had been obviously before. And she suspects that her best friend is sexually active. And she's very much wrestling with whether she wants to be sexually active also. So, I would say that kids are thinking about it. Whether they're actually going through with it and doing it is, the statistics, I think, are pretty high.
So Parker Prescott is the main character.
Yes.
And she is a junior in high school?
Mm-hmm.
And she has just broken up with her boyfriend. Now, something that I found very interesting about the book is the boyfriend, who is described in detail, and he figures prominently in the book, is never named. And why is that?
Well, this is the point where I should tell you that it's some sort of literary genius move, but it really isn't. I struggle with names, so when I first started, I just sort of left him blank. And then as I went along, it sort of became a game in the book to see how long I could go without naming him.
Well, he is very mysterious. His character is very mysterious. And of course, the no name just adds to the mystique. And I will say, I don't think I even realized it until I got almost to the end of the book. And then I thought, I don't think I know his name.
I've had people discuss the book with me and then halfway through the conversation ask, now, what was her boyfriend's name? So people don't seem to notice it. And I didn't want it to come off as gimmicky or anything like that. But after a certain point, it just didn't seem appropriate to put the name in.
Well, he is the quintessential bad boy.
Yeah.
You know, he's new to school. He's mysterious. He's got the leather jacket.
Definitely.
Yeah, I will say of the characters in the book, he is the one. He's the one I think that I had the strongest physical image of. And I don't know if part of that is the mysterious man in all of our lives. We all have an image of him, whether he is in high school or as we age and he ages.
And he's sort of like the book. He's either a love it or hate it thing. And the book has sort of been a love it or hate it book. And he's people either are attracted to him and find him interesting, or they just want to get rid of him and dump him. And, you know, they just loathe him or love him.
Sort of like Ray, Parker's best friend, and Parker.
Yeah. Yes.
The title, Handcuffs, I noticed it had both a literal meaning for a couple of times in the book, and then sort of a figurative meaning. The whole family seems to be handcuffed for different reasons. They're strapped because of the father's unemployment. Then you, of course, have Paige, the sister, the older sister, in her sort of strangled relationship. And I just wondered if that, how you came up with the title.
Well, the whole idea of the story was Parker being trapped. And a lot of that is internal, that she's put herself in this position, that she's this quiet, composed person, and she sort of trapped herself into that. So the image of being trapped sort of goes through the whole book. The title does come from the incident with the handcuffs, and so that's where the title, once that scene was written, I didn't really juggle any other titles. So after that, I kind of knew what the, and some of the other images with the handcuffs sort of came in revisions later with, you know, I don't want to give away anything at the ending, but
that occurs.
Yes, that they come back in later. Sort of was a in revisions thing to make it all fit together.
There's a lot going on in the book, which yes. I think that listeners so far will think, oh my gosh, there's a lot going on in that book. But you have Parker's, you know, relationship, of course, with her mysterious boyfriend. Then you have her relationship with her best friend Ray. Then you have the mess that is her sister Paige. Then you've got her family situation and, you know, the whole family trying to deal with her brother and his issues. And while there's a lot, it did not seem to me that it was overreaching. As a matter of fact, I thought to myself, I wonder how many teens struggle with a life that is truly overwhelming. And do you see that in your job? You are a teacher.
I think that teenage life can be overwhelming, and sometimes it's as simple as getting into college, which isn't something that Parker is really, but getting into college, jobs, grades, and family is very central to teenagers' lives. And I don't think we always realize that, and I don't think they realize how important it is that when their parents are struggling or they're going through situations or focusing, in this case, on the other children in the family, how much it affects kids. So I think that there are a lot going on in teenagers' lives, and that sometimes we get that idea, this is the best time of your life, you're just sitting around, and it really isn't.
That was Robin Fisher talking with local author Bethany Griffin about her first teen novel, Handcuffs. Griffin will read from and sign copies of her book today at 4 at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue. For more information, go to our website, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.